Please help me welcome our speaker tonight, Mike H. from Stepping Stones.
Hello everyone, my name is Mike W. from Stepping Stones. I'm really no big deal. My name's just Mike. I'm a simple alcoholic. There's plenty of Mikes around AA, and my last initials really doesn't matter. I want to thank the group for having me here to speak. I want to say hello to everybody that joined us in on Zoom and everybody that showed up in an in-person meeting here today. I know for myself, in-person meetings were tough for a while. And, you know, I'm grateful my home group, Stepping Stones, we kind of try to stay open as much as possible. And my home group is a clubhouse, which we have no shortage of new alcoholics walking in day in and day out. So, again, my name is Mike. I'm an alcoholic. I have a sober date of June 24th, 2015. June 24th of 2015 was not my first time in AA. My first time in AA was on my birthday in 2006, May 5th. Needless to say, between 2006 and 2015, I had a lot of in and out. I'm not a first time getter or anything like that. I do have a sponsor, and I do walk other guys through the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous today. Again, June 24th was not my first time through the 12 steps. I've been through the 12 steps before, and needless to say, I picked up after that. And in my story, I'll get a little into that and, why I think that happened. So I'm, from Northeast Philadelphia, a little neighborhood called Tacony. It's, far enough from the Badlands, but also close enough to the Badlands. I come from an Irish Catholic family. I have six brothers and sisters. I had two older sisters, an older brother, and two younger brothers. So attention in my family was quite hard to come about from my parents and stuff. So, you know, growing up, ever since I can remember, you know, I was the type of kid, if you dare me to do something, I would do it. And God forbid if you double dog dare me to do something, you know. And again, man, I was always just searching for, you know, attention and a pat on the back. I always overachieved in sports, and you know, it was always just to get that good job, kid. Like, you know, I like that kind of stuff. I don't know if any of this has anything to do with me being an alcoholic. Again, it's just kind of what we do up here. We tell our story. And, you know, I didn't pick up my first drink until junior year of high school. I went to Catholic grade school, Catholic high school. And I did well with grades and all that. I did well with sports. You know, as a junior in high school, when I picked up that first drink, I know all of a sudden I didn't care what people thought of me. And I wanted to do it as much and as often as possible. But again, man, at, you know, 15, 16 years old, that first drink, I don't know if I was an alcoholic from the very start. All I know is that I enjoyed it, what it did to me. You know, that sense of all of a sudden, I don't care what anybody thinks of me. I don't care what, you know, I'm like that overwhelming feeling like, oh, I'm worried about what they think. Am I good enough? Am I, you know, all that stuff was lifted immediately, man. And, you know, I didn't drink every day when I first started. I, you know, drank on the weekends like all the other kids that I grew up with. I got in a little more trouble when I drank. I would fight a lot more often. I would have willingness to talk to females a lot more often. Like, you know, alcohol did that for me. It let me come out of my shell a little more. But again, I don't know if I did it alcoholically from the very start. you know, grade school or high school rather, you know, again, man, I was able to make honors. I was able to play sports. I did get kicked off the basketball team for drinking a 40 and my coach catching me. But again, man, other than that, there's no real trouble that I can remember at that age. After high school, I graduated. I moved down to the Jersey Shore. I got a job as a lifeguard. And within a month, I was kicked off for getting in too much trouble every time while drinking alcohol. You know, again, but I still don't know if I was alcoholic. I was just doing what all the other kids my age and doing what we're doing. We were drinking, we would, you know, have a little too much fun. you know, I was introduced to other substances down the shore, and I enjoyed them also. You know, so my history early on is not that I made a fool of myself. I definitely got in trouble with the police more often and stuff when I was drinking. But I still was able to hold a job and stuff like that. Now I had a brother 14 months older than me, Joey. And me and Joey did everything growing up, right? We played sports together. And Joey went to a public school. He had a whole different group of friends, and they were getting in a lot more trouble. They were experimenting with a lot harder stuff than I ever experimented with. So I knew I didn't want to do that stuff. I was content with, you know, smoking a little here and drinking on the weekends. And again, the people I surrounded myself were accepting to that too. So you know, when I was 22, again, I still lived down the shore during the summers. I worked in the winters as a painter. I remember on, you know, a Sunday family dinner at my mom and dad's house with all the brothers and sisters, my brother standing up and saying he had a problem that he couldn't beat. He was addicted to heroin and he needed help. And I know for me and my brother, we never gave up in anything, whether it be sports, a fight, or anything. You always give your best and never give up, and you still have a chance. And I remember my brother Joey standing up and saying he had a problem. And I stood up, I said, Joe, you're going to wind up dying. You just admitted defeat. Like, that's what I believed back then. And my parents, being the loving parents they were, sent my brother to a detox. Out-of-pocket paid for a detox and rehab down in Florida for my brother. He went down there. He got sober. He came back to Philadelphia, got in a recovery house. He started making AA meetings. And, you know, I had no idea why he had to make these meetings. I had no idea about a recovery house. All I knew is I was getting my brother back. He got his job back. He got his, you know, one-year-old daughter back in his life. And, you know, I was starting to get my brother back. So I could show appreciation for AA, but in reality, I had no idea for it. On July 21st of 2001, every person in that recovery house and the manager show up at my mom's house, and I was the only one home. Every person except for my brother. I said, where's Joey? Did he relapse? They said, yes, he did, and he died. And, you know, that just kind of embedded this idea that he gave up 9 months ago. I knew he was going to die. You know, all that stuff he was doing, see, it didn't work. And, you know, I remember fainting. I remember telling my parents. I remember promising my brothers and sisters and my parents with every ounce of my being that I would never drink or drug again. And needless to say, at my brother's funeral, with my brother dead in a casket, I was pickled next to him. What happened to that promise I just made 2 days prior? And, you know, again, man, I don't know when I became alcoholic. I don't know when I depended on alcohol to deal with everyday life. But I know to deal with my brother dying, I needed alcohol to show up at that funeral. I had no idea. Even in the moment, I had no idea. You know, but all I know is that was the only thing I can rely on for me to feel better in that moment. And now today I know kind of what an alcoholic is. Again, man, I don't know if I was an alcoholic when I first picked up. I may or may not have. But I know in that moment, a few years later, that I was alcoholic. And it doesn't matter when I became alcoholic. The thing that matters is I was alcoholic then. And, you know, I wish I could say my story ended there and I got better. But the fact is I used that as an excuse to continue to do what I was doing. Anytime anybody would approach me and say, Mike, you know, you're getting out of control, I would say, you have no idea how I feel. You would do it too if your brother died. And I wasn't convincing nobody, but I was convincing myself enough to continue to do what I was doing. And, you know, a couple short years later, my mom died of a sudden heart attack. And now I had two excuses of why I was doing what I was doing. You know, and to see my mom's heart break with my brother dying and then knowing what I was continuing to do after that, I truly believe my mom died of a broken heart. You know, she was never sick, never had a bit, you know, never went to the doctors and stuff. But all of a sudden she died of a heart attack, right? And, you know, I'm sure seeing my brother absolutely broke her heart. But to this day, I know seeing me doing the same thing my brother was doing for all those years definitely broke her heart. And that's a reality I have to live with today. So again, man, that was in 2005. At that time, I had met a girl. We had gotten a house together, and she told me she was pregnant.
Wrap up.
No, go the other way. I'll get it. Tell
me if you're free.
Yeah, I like it.
So, you know, in 2005, I meet this girl. My mom just had passed away. Right after that, I find out my girlfriend at the time is pregnant with my first daughter. And again, man, here comes that promise. I'm not going to, my parents, you know, they were most likely alcoholic, right? It's not for us to say, but it's most likely we're alcoholic. To the point that I never want to be like my dad, you know, and I make this promise, man, I'm going to change my ways. I'm going to stop what I'm doing. I'm going to be the best dad ever to this little girl. And I would start trying to control different things, stop one thing and just do another. And, you know, it kind of sort of worked, but it didn't work. That fear of having a new baby into this world, knowing I had an addiction and an alcohol problem, created so much fear that, again, man, the only thing I could do was drink more. And, you know, I had this daughter and, you know, I'm showing up home late. You know, I get paid on Friday. I'm not showing up until Sunday. The paycheck is gone again. I'm making up every excuse in the book. Well, you know what happened? I got robbed again. And, you know, I was the type of guy, if me and you were hanging out, you know, I would tell you to punch me in the eye so she would believe my story. You know, and I would do these things thinking I was convincing somebody. And the real fact is, man, like alcohol became my solution to deal with everyday life. I had no idea how to deal with everyday life without alcohol in my life. again, man, I come home on a Sunday after getting paid on Friday and the girlfriend changed the locks. And, you know, my best idea was going to empty our bank account and go on a run. And that's what I did, man. I went on a 10-day run. And I show up at my sister's house begging for something to eat when I was broke. And my sister said, Michael, I'll feed you if you go away and get help. And at that point, I could see the devastation in my life. I could see how I was hurting the girlfriend at the time. More importantly, I could see how I wasn't being the father I always wanted to be to this new daughter I had. And, you know, I made a deal with my sister, just feed me and I'll go away. And that's what I did. My sister made a phone call, and within an hour, a guy from AA showed up at my door that I never met in my life, and he was willing to take me to a rehab. I went to Living Grin, and again, man, I could see the destruction in my life. I wanted to get better. I was willing to get better. I went through the detox. I went through the 28-day program, and had a great experience. when I had 28 days in that program, we had a family visit and the girlfriend, my daughter came up to see me. And, you know, I was like, I went away. I'm ready to come home. I'm going to change. And she said, no, I don't think that's a good idea. You should go to a recovery house. And I agreed. Okay, if that's what you want me to do, that's what I'll do. I'll do anything to get my family back. And that's what I did. I went to a house called the Mother of Perpetual Health House in Northeast Philadelphia. And I was introduced to the Stepping Stones. It's right around the corner from this clubhouse. And, you know, again, man, great experience with AA. I get into this house. I meet a bunch of great guys. I meet a bunch of great people in AA. I get involved with sober softball and, you know, the fellowship. And we had a coffee place we used to go to and hang out. And my life started getting decent, you know, where I could show up to work every day. Again, I had this whole new group of friends, and, you know, it seemed like AA was working. When I had 6 months sober, I told the girlfriend, now I have 6 months, I'm ready to come home. She said, no, I still don't think you're ready. I said, F you, I'll show you. I had no idea I had conditions on my sobriety up until that point. The first time I didn't get what I thought I expected or what I wanted, I had no solution in my life. I had to go back to the only thing I always knew, and that was drinking and other things. And that started a bad run. Back then in the city, if you had city funding, you know, if you went away too much, they would exhaust your funding. They wouldn't offer you help anymore. And I did that. I would go to detox. I would stay sometimes. I would leave AMA sometimes. And, you know, the state was not willing to pay for my funding anymore because I was in and out so much. What I did do, I would stay in touch with the manager of that first recovery house. And, you know, I would call him. I would say, Juan, do you have a bed for me? I really need a bed. He's like, Mike, you've always been a decent guy when you're here. You're welcome back anytime. All you need is a clean urine. I would say, all right, Juan, I'll call you back in 3 days with a clean urine. 4-5 months would go by, and I would call this man back. Say, Juan, can I please get a bed? He would say, sure, Michael, all I need is a clean urine. All right, Juan, I'll call you back in 3 days. And I meant this every single time I would call this man. I wasn't calling him to say hi. I was calling him because I wanted my life to change. And again, months would go by. I would finally call this man, crying my eyes out. And I told him, I said, Juan, I'm going to die out here trying to get you a clean urine. And the simple fact, my willpower wasn't enough to get a clean urine out there. Because usually my first thought is I want to kill myself. My second thought is how can I get it better? And then my third thought, it's not so bad. And that cycle, man, that cycle is I'll go away tomorrow was every single day for quite some time. So Juan lets me come back into this house in 2010. And, you know, I'm not feeling well at the time. I walk into the Stepping Stones in the clubhouse, and this guy, Ricky, I used to play softball with, was there. And, you know, this guy, Ricky, was cool to play softball with, but he was also that dude that told you, that, you know, if you want to stay alive, Mike, you might want to do these steps. Do you need help? I don't know about all that. I just want a couple friends. I want to stay sober. But this guy, he said, Mike, how are you doing? I said, Rick, not so well. And he said, I know, I can tell you look like death. And for the first time in my life, somebody told me exactly how I was feeling on the inside. I'm used to feeling like death, but going up to somebody and they're telling me I'm doing good. I couldn't relate to that because that's not how I was feeling. When this man looked me in my eye and told me I was looking like death, my next question was like, well, what do I got to do? And this man was kind enough to take me through the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. And again, man, I had a great experience. we went through the steps. You know, I identified as an alcoholic. Once I start, I cannot stop. And once I put it down, I cannot keep it down. That has been my history for as long as I can remember. Since the day my brother died, I swore I was never going to do it again. And that had happened thousands of times after that moment. So Ricky takes me through the steps, and again, man, I had a great experience. I made amends. I start working for an old employer. He signed his business over to me. You know, I made amends with my family. They welcomed me back with open arms. I had my kid daughter back in my life, Emily. And I met a new girl in AA. You know, we got a house together. She got her son back in her life. And everything seemed like it was going fine. Dana was pregnant with my second daughter. And, you know, during her hospital stay, she had a C-section. And she was prescribed Percs, and she picked up after our daughter was born. And, you know, she hid it for a while. I kind of knew, but I didn't really know. But I became very resentful. And, you know, what I did with that again is I relapsed also. I had 14 months in the time. And me and Dana were each doing our thing, hiding it for each other until we said, F it, you're doing this, I'm doing this, let's do it together. And, you know, again, my life went in a quick downward spiral. In that time, I crashed 3 vehicles. I wasn't making enough money to support me and Dana's habit, so I start stealing every day after work. And it was quite easy. You walk in Home Depot, you take a couple items and walk out. And this one time I walk in and there's this big guy following me, waving to me. I'm like, you alright, dude? Pretty weird. And this dude follows me out while I have stuff. And we go to pick up Dana's son at a Catholic school. We pull into the parking lot and there's a detective with his lights on behind us. And in the schoolyard with all the nuns out there, all the parents and all the teachers, five other cop cars pull up and they fell and arrest me with guns drawn. And I get hit with 14 counts of retail theft. So my thinking it was easy every time, really they were just watching and waiting to catch me. So I get locked up. Dana still has a habit and she's home with these two kids. I get out after a short time, and again, the whole time in jail, I'm going to change my ways, I'm going to do better, I need to get my family back, and I have all these great ideas. I get released to a recovery house in Bucks County, and again, my main focus is to get my family back, to start doing right. I get a job right away, I get the girlfriend back, I get my kid back in my life, and not much AA. I was making mandatory meetings and stuff like that, and I remember Dana, we lost our house, by the way, when I got locked up. They did a full clean out, they took everything. And the material is one thing. I'm used to losing material things and regaining material things, but this time in this house, they took all my brother's memorabilia, all my mom's memorabilia. They took my kids' birth certificates. Just everything of importance was gone. And again, man, I remember, man, I need to change my ways. I want to change my ways. But again, my main focus was getting my family back. I needed to be a man. I needed to do what was right. Dana was living with her mom at the time. And she called me at work one day and tells me she gets kicked out of her mom's house. And again, I have an idea why, but I ask her and she tells me, she relapsed and she's been getting on. I said, what are we going to do? We got to get better. And she's like, all I want to do is go and get some. I said, F it, let's go. And with my one-year-old daughter in the back seat, we go, we buy something. And right off the bat, I did enough to overdose with my daughter in the back seat driving. Again, man, this is how I show up when I want to be all I want is to be the best dad ever. And I remember getting woken up by the police. They asked me if I want to help. I said no. And I probably made the most unselfish decision I ever made when I was doing what I was doing. I said, we need to drop Gracie off at your sister's house so we can continue to do what I'm about to do. And that's what we did. We dropped my daughter off. We went to a hotel. And for the second time that day, I overdosed. And again, man, my brother overdosed back in 2001. People used to tell me, like, he just accidentally did too much. From being away from it for so long, he just accidentally did too much. And I believed that for a long time until I started overdosing myself. Not once did I accidentally overdose. I was to the point in my life that knew exactly what I was about to do could take me out, and I was okay with that end result. I was sick and tired of letting people down. I was sick and tired of letting myself down. I was sick and tired of not being able to live up to the dad I wanted to be, the brother I wanted to be, the son I wanted to be. And if what I was about to do could take me out, I was okay with that result. So that took me on another run. Again, man, I get arrested again for my old ways. I get arrested for a couple more counts of retail theft. And this time was different when I got locked up. They asked me if I wanted a phone list. I said, I don't have nobody that I can put on that phone list. They said, what about an emergency contact? I said, I don't have not one name to put as an emergency contact. This is a guy with six brothers and sisters, a dad at the time, a girlfriend, my daughter's grandparents, two different babies' moms, and I don't have not one person to put as an emergency contact. And I was faced with this reality that I can't blame nobody no more. It wasn't my dad's fault being an alcoholic. It wasn't my brother's fault for dying. It wasn't my mom's fault. It was nobody's fault but my own. This is the reality I had to face in the jail cell with nobody putting money on my books, nobody to call, but the reality that I had to face the facts. And this was June 24, 2015. I think that admittance, you know, in the big book they talk about the first step of recovery is, what do they say? we had to concede to our innermost self. And I think this is really the first time I ever did that. Not that I just raised my hand and say I'm an alcoholic, but I had to admit and accept the fact that I was a real alcoholic. And that my life was unmanageable every time I try to make do what I want to do. My thoughts are, my motives are usually pretty good. Like, there's nothing wrong with trying to be a good dad or being the man of a house. The problem is when I do that stuff, I take it to the extremes. And when I don't think it works out how I think it should, I have no solution to fall back on. So again, man, I'm in this house, or I'm in jail. June 24th, and I sit there a couple months. This guy Jeff used to bring in the means to the jail, big book study. I used to make that mean on Thursday night religiously, and I used to talk to this guy Jeff. I used to, you know, kind of used him as like a sponsor in there, really. I would start talking to Jeff. I said, Jeff, what should I do in here? You know, I kind of know some of the big book. You know, he told me to write a four-step. I said, okay, the following week I would go over it real quick. And obviously nobody was talking to me. I couldn't call nobody, so I couldn't make many amends in jail. But what he did tell me to do is start helping guys in there. I said, Jeff, I'm in jail. It's not the most popular thing to do in here. You know, but it's exactly what I did, man. I started having big book studies in my jail cell, and I started helping guys coming in that I could physically see that were sick. And I can tell you what, with not a dollar on my books that whole time, not with one person to call, it was the easiest jail time I ever did in my life. Probably because I wasn't focused so much on myself. So I find out that they're releasing me pre-release. All I needed was an address, because needless to say, I didn't have an address going into jail, nor did I have one coming out of jail. But to be released, I needed a address, and my, you know, sponsor, my buddy Rick, he was the manager at the Keystone Recovery Houses down in Philadelphia. They have like six houses. So Jeff was nice enough to give me Rick's phone number. Excuse me. So yes, Jeff was nice enough to give me Rick's phone number, and I call Rick. I say, hey Rick, it's me, Mike. I'm in jail again. Do you think I can come back to Leaper Street? And Rick says, no. I said, what do you mean no, Rick? It's me, Mike. He's like, Mike, I know exactly who it is, and I don't want to be responsible for you dying knowing the big books of Alcoholics Anonymous. I said, damn, Rick, that was harsh. But what I did do was I start bawling my eyes out, and I begged Rick to let me back. I told him I would do whatever he wanted me to do. And Rick said, okay. So Rick met me at the recovery house when they let me out. And, you know, the first thing I asked for Rick, can I get a pack of cigarettes? He said, absolutely. Go on Walgreens, grab yourself a pack of cigarettes, and also grab yourself a book, a copy book, and a pen. I said, okay. And as soon as I came out of there, I said, Rick, can I borrow your phone? He said, who the hell are you gonna call? I said, I gotta call my daughter's grandma. That's where Gracie's living. He's like, Mike, that's probably not a good idea. I said, okay, cool, baby. Let me see your phone. And I reach out to this woman, Debbie. I say, hey, Deb, it's Mike. I just want to talk to my daughter. I would love to see her. I just got out of jail. And her response was, F you, you scumbag. I hope you get a bad bag and die. I said, damn, Rick, I shouldn't have done that. You know, but what he asked me next was, Mike, do you owe child support? I said, of course I do, Rick. He's like, I want you to get a job and start paying immediately. And again, man, my response was, no, I'll start paying child support once that B lets me see my kid. And Rick said, no, idiot, why don't you start paying child support and maybe you'll get to see your kid again. I said, oh. And that's what I did. I had a job within a week and my first payment went to child support. You know, I have another friend, Marie, that suggested I do something else. She suggested that I text this lady every Friday and thank her for all she does for my daughter. She said, how am I supposed to do that? She said, simple, learn the resentment prayer. I said, oh. And I would learn this resentment prayer and I would say it every Friday. God, please let me see Debbie as a sick person just like me. Please let me show her the same patience, pity, and tolerance I would cheerfully grant a sick friend. And I would send a text. Hey, Deb, thanks for everything you do for my daughter. And sometimes I would get a response, F you, you scumbag. And sometimes I wouldn't get a response at all. But I would continue to do that. Rick also suggested that I start putting an extra $100 in her stove for child care for my daughter. And I start doing that. You know, obviously, as soon as I got that copy book and pen, I got to work, right? We went through the first 3 steps because I had some knowledge of the big book and I kind of, you know, were familiar with it. So we kind of went pretty quick. By the end of the first day, meeting up with Rick, I was doing a 4-step and a 5th step. And, you know, he had me write a whole page of resentment on Justine and my girlfriend at the time, or ex-girlfriend at the time. And then another one on just Debbie, and that was long. You know, cause how dare her not let me see my kid. And, you know, I got to see the truth of the matter. But, you know, how dare me think this woman should have tried to be the best grandmother she can and keep me away from her cause I destroyed that little girl's life. And I start to see the reality, man, of how spiritually sick I really was. That no matter how good of a person I wanted to be, I lacked the power to live up to that. That unimaginability of the first step and the spiritual sickness really came alive when I went through a 4th and 5th step this time. It showed me exactly how much I needed God's help if I wanted to be the person I wanted to be. You know, it showed me what kind of person I was as a son, as a brother. You know, I used to, like, my brothers and sisters were all on there, right? Just one lump thing. How dare them not send my kids a Christmas card or a birthday card? I don't care if they don't talk to me, but how dare them not be an aunt or an uncle to my kid? Well, who was the common factor in that? Who was the one not allowing them to have a relationship with my daughter? It was me. And again, man, I had to face the fact that it was me as the common denominator in all these relationships. And, you know, again, man, I knew at that point that I really needed God's help, not just for the alcohol problem, but to be a member of society. And we continue to go through the steps, and he had me write out this fear list. And my number one fear was if anything bad happened to Dana, because I felt some responsibility, right? We used together, and I knew she was struggling at the time, and I knew I couldn't get through it if anything bad happened to this woman. And, you know, I again, man, in the beginning, I couldn't make amends. My brothers and sisters wanted to hear nothing from me. They didn't care if I was sober. They went, been there, done that. They welcomed me back with open arms. And again, once I relapsed, started doing what I was doing, they were like, that's it. We already gave you a chance. So with 6 months sober, you know, after texting Debbie every single Friday, after paying some consecutive payments on child support, this woman texted me and said, hey, Mike, would you like to see your daughter for an hour in my basement? I said, absolutely. I showed up on time. I spent an hour with my daughter, and I left on time. And she offered me that, you know, the next weekend. And the next weekend, I think it got up to 2 hours. And every time I was there, we would start kind of talking a little bit, you know. I kind of made amends. She really didn't want to hear it. She's like, you know, you can spend time with your daughter. She's like, but I don't understand how Dana continues to do this to her kids. And I got to talk to her. I, you know, let her know, like, I never done anything to my kids. The fact that I couldn't be the dad I wanted to be kept me out there. And it's probably the same for Dana. She's probably so upset that she can't be the mom she wants to be that the only thing that helps is drinking more. And we start to build this relationship. And, you know, my sponsor is one of those guys, like, he'll say these little things like, you know, Mike, you might want to do this work before you need it. And it's like, okay, like, what do you, What's he talking about? You know, but thank God I did the work before I need it. With 10 months sober, Debbie called me and said, Mike, can you come over here and watch your daughter? I got to go to Temple Hospital. Dana overdosed. So I get over there. About an hour goes by. She's like, Mike, if you want to come down here, I think you should come down. And Dana was in a coma for 5 days before she passed away. And, you know, Dana's dad still wanted to wring my neck at the time. And with his daughter dying, that did not help one bit. But I would sit there in that hospital every night while Dana was in a coma. And while they were at the hospital, I would sit at their house with my daughter while they can go see their daughter in a coma. And again, man, my number one fear was if anything bad happened to Dana, I don't think I could ever get through it. But again, man, my sponsor was the guy who said, you might want to do this work before you need it. And he had me start saying that fear prayer well before this moment. And I would say, God, if anything bad happened to Dana, God, please remove my fear if anything bad happened to Dana and direct my attention to what you would have me be. And what would God have me be? He would have me be a good father. And I focused on that, man, and I tried to be a good father. And, you know, and thank God I did, man. Dana's family hated me, but the simple fact that I was able to be there for them while they were going through one of the hardest moments in their life probably kept me sober. More importantly, I had no idea this program was working in my life at this time. I only had 10 months. Again, I really didn't know it was working yet. Kind of knew maybe something was happening. But what I do remember is sitting in that ER room, in the waiting room, and seeing all my brothers and sisters walk through that door, and my dad. And none other than Debbie, the person that wished me getting a band bag and dying, leans over and says, see, Dana did love you. She got your family back for you. I said, oh, shit. This shit is really working. And again, man, since that moment, me and Debbie are not always on best terms. We had, a custody battle for my daughter. But at times, this woman will call me her best friend, which is amazing. sometimes I still got to use that resentment prayer too with her, But that's just this program of this recovery. The simple fact that I can have a relationship with this woman that wished death on me blows my mind. Again, that was with 10 months sober, and since then, my life has totally changed. At that time, I had no custody rights for neither of my daughters. since then, I owed amounts of money in child support. So real quick, other than that, when I got out of jail, the problems I were looking at was I had no contact with neither of my siblings. I had 12 indefinite suspensions on my license. I had, no communication with my family members. I had, huge amounts of debt. And I can literally say when I was thinking about those problems, they were so overwhelming. What I can sit here and say today is they're all gone. I now have a license back. I have multiple vehicles. I now have full custody of Gracie. And those problems, if you just put your feet one in front of the other, they go away, man, if you give yourself a chance. that's kind of my story and that's kind of what happened. But what it's now like is way, way behind my wildest dreams. I just celebrated 7 years couple weeks ago. And, man, what my life is today is beyond amazing. And, I married another beautiful girl in the program. We met a long time back in 2010. And, we actually reconnected on Bumble of any other places. But these are not things that I ever thought were possible for a guy like me. We raise our daughters together. And at times that is testing, but we get through it with the program of AA. We both work the program we were taught in here. And, I also own another business. I have a business partner. which one of my closest guy in this program. Like, my life is surrounded with people in AA. The only people that I, you know, at our wedding, probably 75% of the people were sober. My wedding party were my sponsor, another best one of my friends in AA, like four of my best friends, my partner, all AA people. Elena obviously was sober. She's my wife. She'll have 20 years in a couple of weeks. Her dad has 38 years. Her brothers are both sober. So our life is fulfilled with sober people, and it's the greatest gift I got, man. You know, like, I have family having a July 4th bash, and we don't need to go to that, you know? We have enough sober people that we can have our own sober bash with, and that's a blessing to me, man. You know, I have a successful business today, again, man, but I did things right these times. You know, I have another friend named Rob, and he always talks about the natural order of things. I'm like, Rob, what are you talking about when you say that? Well, he's like, you know, get your license back first before you get a car. I said, how? You know, or why don't you get a relationship with your kid before you get any relationship? Oh. You know, like, that was never my story. Like, I would always put the cart in front of the horse. I would always be like, God, let me get in a relationship and then get a relationship with my daughter. And I can honestly say, man, this time I focused on the natural order of things. Like, I had a relationship with my daughter before Elena and I got in a relationship. Probably made me a little more attractive, I hope. You know, but it's things like that that, you know, I don't know, like, man, I tried to tell guys today, man, my sponsees, like, you know, there's been quite a few guys that I took through the steps. Not that many. I got all the way up to 12, let alone 9. But there's been a few. And there's two guys that I actively sponsor now that are a breath of fresh air, man. It's the most rewarding thing I have. And, you know, the truth be told is, like, my life is so busy today from AA that the reality is, like, my mean attendance is I make the Stepping Stones Big Book Studies almost every Wednesday. And, you know, I'm very lucky when I get opportunities like this. And every now and again, Elena will speak, or I'll get to go to an odd meeting during the week. But every week, I'm at least at Wednesday night meeting. And for an alcoholic like me, that might not be enough. Like, the real credit why I get to sit here today is from my sponsees. You know, they're the one thing that keep me accountable. They're the one thing that when they tell me, when I tell them to do stuff, I make sure that I'm doing it. If I'm telling them to do meditation, I make sure I'm doing it. You know, and when I have guys, I get to see their lives flourish. Like, I have a guy celebrating a year next week. And when I first came around, this guy had about 7 years sober. And he's been struggling for about 10 years. Could not get over a month, man. And he's done a lot of damage out there. And we went through the work, and he'll tell us the one thing he's never did, even with all that time sober, is go through these steps. And to see him, he calls me every day, and he tells me how these things are working. It's such a pleasure, man. And in reality, man, it's things like that that keep me sober. I said, you know, back in 2010, I went through the steps, and I relapsed. For the longest time, I would say, I must be rarely ever seen in person. That's me. I did everything he asked, and I still relapsed. The reality is I went through the steps and that was it. My first time through the steps, I had no idea I had to practice these things in my affairs every single day. I didn't know I had to learn the resentment prayer. I didn't know I had to learn the fear prayer for when I get feared up. I didn't know I had to continue to make amends. I didn't know I had to continue to pray and meditate. All I did is went through the steps and start helping other guys. And my reality is, if I do that and count on that, it ain't gonna work. If I don't learn the resentment prayer for when I get resentful, if I don't learn the fear prayer for when I get fearful, if I don't continue to ask God for His will and what that is and try to live up to it, it's only a matter of time until I go back to that solution. I gotta take the solution that AA offers me into everyday daily living if I wanna stay sober. And I thank guys like you and ladies like you for showing me that way. It's only for people like you that show me that time and time again and welcome me back with open arms that I get an opportunity to stand here. And I thank you all for that. I think that's all I have. Thank you for letting me share.